The headlines, the U.S. vote counting continues in a few key states as President Donald Trump and his contender Joe Biden both claim to be ahead in the election. Post-election rival protests break out in several U.S. cities, with one group demanding vote counting to stop, while the other asks for counting to continue. And the EU warns that the bloc's economy will not return to pre-coronavirus normality before 2023 amid the pandemic's devastating economic repercussions. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Final results are trickling in for a few remaining states in the U.S. where incumbent President Donald Trump is battling former Vice President Joe Biden. The race is tight in Georgia, Nevada, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania. Biden needs only six more electoral votes to secure the 270 required to win the nail-biter contest. Trump has won 214. He claimed victory on Wednesday before millions of votes were counted. He is now demanding an end to the vote counting, alleging voter fraud. His campaign has announced that a lawsuit is going to be filed in Nevada. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe is an international observer to the U.S. election. The group accused Donald Trump of a gross abuse of office by questioning the soundness of the election. Protests and violence from supporters of both U.S. presidential candidates have erupted in several cities as vote counting is underway. Supporters of President Donald Trump demanded a thorough recount of ballots. They also called for racial justice. Police arrested at least 50 demonstrators after violence broke out. In Portland, 11 people were arrested as protests continued throughout the night. Authorities said the National Guard was deployed due to widespread violence. Clashes also took place in Washington, D.C. and several other cities. In Detroit, Trump supporters demonstrated outside an election facility and called for the suspension of the count. Supporters of former Vice President Joe Biden expressed mounting fears that Republican incumbent might not accept the election results if he were to lose. For more on that, who better than Colin Campbell to join us from Washington, D.C. to give us an update. Now, Colin, if you could please tell us how likely do you see this from happening, Trump not accepting the results if he does not win?
Well, what we know for sure is that the president will try to fight this in courts, especially if he doesn't come out to be the victor. Now, if he does come out to be the victor, we can expect that any type of recalcitrance, any type of resistance to the results will be dashed away. But if it is shown, or if it is announced, or if it is alluded to in a strong way, or if it is official that the former vice president does win the election, beating out the current president, we can imagine that the president will fight tooth and nail to put this into the courts, to try to litigate this as much as possible before January, before he really has to exit the White House. And the reasons for this are myriad. One, the ego loss to the president of losing to the former vice president. Then there could be a raft of legal issues that the president is facing once he vacates the White House. And then, of course, just the loss of the confidence that he's had in the American people to some degree. Now, he'll always have his loyal followers, but we can definitely know for sure that once the president has already filed lawsuits, that there are more to follow, especially in some of those key battleground states like North Carolina, like Pennsylvania, like Arizona. even Wisconsin, even though he has called for a recount there. Election officials have said that that would really be a pipe dream for the president to try to reverse what has already been called for the former vice president. But still, we still see a president who is somewhat desperate, one who is not really willing to back down or cave in, and is willing to fight this as much as possible all the way until the end, until he can't anymore, if he does not become the victor in the end.
So, Colin, if you could please map this out for us, what are the legal means that he has in hand if he wants to pursue this in court?
Well, he would have to go to start out with the lower courts, right? Each state court, and bring this as a lawsuit, whether, and it depends on what he sues for. It could be the loss of counting the votes. It could be procedure. It could be people counting votes after the election day, which is something he's also expressed a dissatisfaction over. And then it would go to a higher court if it fails in the lower court. And then if that still fails, it would have to go all the way to the Supreme Court, which is what the president is hoping for. And many people believe that that is why they pushed through Amy Coney Barrett, would be for situations like this, where the president would be hoping that it goes in his favor for a legal verdict that would help him in the end.
So are you saying that the Supreme Court could actually turn the results of the elections around?
Well, we've seen the Supreme Court have an effect on elections with the hanging chads about 20 years ago, and there is a possibility that the Supreme Court could have an effect on this election. Now, of course, these other courts would really have to show that they could not litigate or could not make a decisive decision on whatever the president is suing over for it to go to that level. But yes, the Supreme Court could have an influence on the U.S. elections. It has before. There's already been precedent. This would be no different.
And finally, Colin, everyone around the world is watching the results of these elections. Over the past couple of hours, we haven't seen any results actually coming in, and we still have the 264 electoral votes for Biden and 214 for Donald Trump. When do you think we will have some more results coming in?
Yeah, so the 264 number is the number that the Associated Press, usually a very highly esteemed news agency in the U.S., is calling Arizona for the former vice president. And some other stations and networks have been reluctant to do so because those votes are still coming in. When it comes to states like Pennsylvania, I don't think we'll have a decision before Friday, but other states like North Carolina and then Michigan, Wisconsin, those are going to be more decisive. They're already mostly the way there now. I believe Arizona, they should have a better number by this evening, but Pennsylvania may not be decided until the weekend. So I think we still have to hold tight here up until at least Saturday. Most of the states will be in, maybe just one or two will be counting their votes. And also Nevada. I believe Nevada should have in their numbers by tonight as well.
Thank you very much. Our correspondent Colin Campbell, live from Washington, D.C. Moving on, what happens in the U.S. elections will play a vital role in the next 4 years of U.S. foreign policy, in particular when it comes to Iran and China. Already since taking the helm in 2016, Donald Trump has managed to intensify tensions with both nations through his aggressive policies. But for whoever sits in the White House next, what will be their policies and what will that resemble in the next 4 years?
The outcome of the US election will of course play a vital role in how the US progresses over the next 4 years, from the handling of the COVID-19 virus to the racial inequality protests that are part of everyday life in the country. But what about the Americans' relations with other countries, in particular Iran and China? For a start, Iran has made it very clear that the outcome of the election will have no effect on how Iran views the United States. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, made this very clear in a recent speech. However, at the end of the day, either Trump or Biden will one day take the seat at the White House, and the topic of Iran will no doubt come up. Yet as things stand, Iran has seen what Trump is capable of when dealing with Iran, including the assassination of top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, as well as Trump pulling out of the JCPOA and imposing sanctions on the nation, which has raised the speculation that Iran could see Biden as a more promising candidate as president. Backing up what was said by the leader, Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, has also pointed out that it's not important what slogans and promises are made before the election by either Trump or Biden, but what is actually acted on after winning the election, clearly showing that Iran is cautious of more false promises by the Americans. It hence raises the question as to why exactly Iran should trust the United States over the next 4 years, even if the Americans do initially show some kind of diplomatic outreach.
Well, I think it is quite clear that there is absolutely no real reason for Iran to trust the United States in any way, shape or form, no matter who of the two major candidates right now wins the elections. Of course, we have seen that Donald Trump is more of the loose cannon, let's say, more of a rabid dog, if you want to say it that way, in terms of diplomacy towards the Islamic Republic of Iran in particular, especially regarding the assassination of Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis and the general approach towards Iran in regards to the sanctions, of course, and the destruction of the JCPOA. Agreement.
With Biden likely to emulate some of the steps taken by Obama in signing the JCPOA, for Trump, the situation is different. What is clear is that should he wish to show any sign of improving ties with Iran, then he'll have to take on a whole new approach. However, as mentioned, Iran has clearly stated that it's not interested in dealing with the US, hence potentially opening the door to alternative options for Iran.
The next 4 years hold more dilemmas for the United States, regardless of who takes the keys to the Treasury Department. Trump's legacy has so far brought about a trade war with China and an emerging Cold War with Russia, potential conflict with North Korea, and failed diplomacy with Iran. Could the next term hence see a continuation of this, or will the next president seek to change the U.S. foreign policy for the better? What happens next could be largely determined by China. As the world's second largest economy and fast approaching the top spot, ties between the U.S. and China have truly shown a sweet and sour side over the last 4 years. But could the U.S. relationship with Iran lead China to step in as the Islamic Republic's global partner? And if so, how will Washington react?
Over the last 4 years, Trump's relations with global nations has truly resembled a pendulum, with his rhetoric and feelings towards the countries and their leaders swinging left to right in a worrying bipolar fashion. China, for one, has seen this behavior, with Trump initially holding good ties with the Chinese president Xi Jinping. However, the bromance soon turned sour over trade and allegations of the coronavirus being made in China, leaving the Chinese now hoping for Biden to win. Yet much like Iran, China have little optimism that much will change under Biden. However, there is a flip side to the coin. Much in the same way that Iran has been able to develop under its own steam through economic sanctions, some in China claim that Trump winning could benefit China's growth, as Trump leads the US down the wrong path, hence paving the way for China to blossom. An example of the growth that China has been able to enjoy is the relationship that it has with Iran, with the Chinese and Iranians having penned a draft accord that could see the countries agree to a 25-year trade deal, which could spell problems for the West as the two nations strike a deal that could see both China and the Iranian economies prosper. But should the US hence not act fast when it comes to Iran, could the Sino-Iranian deal leave the US empty-handed?
I think that, again, no matter who wins, at this point, I think it is already too late. I think it would be a major mistake for Iran to think like, oh, based on maybe who wins, we could revert our policy in regards to signing this treaty, this 25-year treaty with China. Or if Iran were to say, maybe we should restart our negotiations regarding, you know, nuclear energy, nuclear power, and sign a new treaty with the United States. I think this would be a major step backwards, especially when we have seen that there are a lot of people, a lot of nations, even allies of the United States, even NATO member states in Europe, for example, who oppose the warmongering policy by the United States. Finally, after so many decades, have decided that the United States has gone too far.
As much as the United States claims that it is the global power, the international political and economic arena is fast changing. And with new powers and partnerships emerging, the next US president has a tough 4 years ahead, whoever that might be.
Moving on, Europe is witnessing a surge in coronavirus cases and deaths, prompting several governments to implement strict lockdown measures to slow the spread of the pandemic. Poland registered over 27,000 new coronavirus infections, breaking its daily record. Greece also announced a three-week lockdown due to a surge in daily COVID-19 cases. So far, 673 people have died from the disease in Greece. Elsewhere in Europe, Russia said the coronavirus situation in the country was alarming after the country reported a near daily record of some 20,000 new cases. Ukraine, Germany, and the Czech Republic have all reported new daily records of infection. Several European countries, including France, Germany, and England, have already imposed new month-long lockdowns to combat the virus resurgence. The European Union has warned that the bloc's economy will not return to the pre-coronavirus levels before 2023.
Of the recession in 2020 and the speed of the recovery in 2021 and 2022 are expected to vary widely across member states. Nearly half of our member states are not expected to recover their pre-pandemic level of GDP by the end of 2022.
In a news conference in Brussels, the EU's Economic Affairs Commissioner said a recovery of Europe's economy has been interrupted by the second wave of the pandemic. Paolo Gentiloni says the Eurozone economy will grow much lower next year than what was predicted in July. The outbreak of the novel coronavirus has dealt a major blow to global economies. As a result, unemployment rates have soared in many countries. The United States has reported yet another daily record in coronavirus infections, registering nearly 100,000 new cases. That is according to data from Johns Hopkins University. Data also show that the country has suffered more than 1,100 new coronavirus-related deaths in 24 hours only. The U.S. is the world's hardest-hit country by the pandemic in terms of both infections and fatalities. Nearly 9.5 million people have so far been diagnosed with the disease there. The country's death toll now stands at over 233. Moving on, UN experts have sounded the alarm over the health of a female Saudi activist who has gone under strike, hunger strike that is, in detention. The UN Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women issued a statement on Lujain al-Hathloul's condition. The committee said that her health is rapidly deteriorating and that she should be released immediately. The rights experts have voiced outrage that the national security-related charges leveled against Hathloul were in part justified by her engagement with the committee. Hathloul was arrested along with around a dozen women activists in May 2018. She has been branded as a traitor by the Kingdom's state media. Her family says that she's been subjected to sexual harassment and torture in jail. And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Dark Review.
Hello. Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing The House on Cocoa Road, directed by Damani Baker. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Telegraph, The Guardian, and many others. And alongside him is Lee Jasper, who is a former policing director for London and social justice campaigner. He is also a Black Sox sponsor, which was formed in 2015 as a result of events concerning the increasing levels of violence impacting London's black communities. Now, The House on Cocoa Road is the story of director Damani Baker's family, particularly about his mother's story, Fanny Houghton, who moved her children from Oakland, California, to participate in the Grenada Revolution, only to find her family in harm's way of a US military invasion. This film also sheds light on the history of black power movements and their struggle for racial equality.
I call the United States home, but this country has a painful legacy of violence that we still struggle to confront.
I think we always have to find something that holds a promise, and that way we look toward the future.
You're committed to humanity, to making the world a better place. You know, not just for your family, but everybody's family. We were trying to make sense of this world.
One of the most important things that has to be done in the process of carrying out a revolutionary struggle is to merge the personal with the political, where they're no longer separate.
You have this situation where we are trying to build a new society.
Grenada is the southernmost of the Windward Islands in the West Indies.
Here's our revolutionary government right here in our own hemisphere.
It was a utopia.
And the next thing I knew, she was packing you all up.
Grenada, we were told, was a friendly island paradise for tourism. Well, it wasn't. It was a Soviet Cuban colony being readied as a major military bastion to export terror and undermine democracy.
I took my young children out of my country to come here to help this country. I left in pain. This is the first time I've been back, so you've got to be very sensitive.
I remember you asking me, as the bombs dropped and the island shook, you said, this must be what they call war.
There is a freedom tide rising in our hemisphere. The spirit of democracy is assuming its rightful role as the great unifier of the people.
The shooting! The shooting!
My mother always said that this is not the way things are supposed to be. And if we work towards change, conditions will become different.
Long live peace in our Americas and in the world. Forward ever, backward never.
Well, first of all, a very warm welcome to you both. Thanks very much for joining the show. Now, this documentary gives you an insightful and historical look at race relations in the US and also offers an alternative look at the US-led invasion of Grenada, but from a black perspective. And Mike, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on this film?
I think it's a very strong film. It's a very engaging film. I think what it does particularly well, there's a clip very early on where Angela Davis, the great black activist, is saying, we need to make the personal political. And this is exactly what this film does. It starts with this opening montage of footage from various tapes that Damani Baker, the director, has found in, I think, the garage of his mother when he was moving her house, when she was moving house. Yeah, and you know, so you've got footage from, you know, 83, 99, 2015, all spliced together. You get a sense of a young man, young filmmaker, piecing these disparate frames and images together, trying to work out what they represent. But he does so in a way that's incredibly casual. It doesn't feel like a serious history lesson. It feels like you've been invited over to someone's house on a Sunday morning. They're telling you about their family history over coffee and cake. It's sort of deceptively casual, but it does build to a much bigger picture of American life and black American life in particular.
And Lee, if I could turn to you now, why is it important to revisit these topics? We see like a trail of sort of documentaries coming out about black power movements, and we've covered quite a few on this show with the Black Panther Party and so forth. What relevance does it have today?
Yeah, it's great relevance, and I think when you look at the historical film that we have, particularly with films like this, It's surprising how much contemporary resonance it has with the situation of African-American communities today in America. But it also speaks, I think, that film to a broader narrative. And it's this perpetual search within the African diaspora for that home, that place, that belonging. And wherever it is, from wherever our particular roots are, we have a deep need to be reconnected. And I think that what you're looking at is African Americans seeking to escape the predations of Jim Crow, you know, racism and its legacies in America, going to Grenada and then finding themselves at the end of an imperialist gun. And I thought that was a powerful narrative. You've sought to escape racism, but actually you've ended up in a place where American imperialism has rolled up on the Grenadian shores with devastating consequences. And I also think the narrative about black women's leadership role in having to make decisions about their family, where they live, what quality of life they will like. Those are the kind of conversations that I think are, you know, very deep within black communities of, can we survive here? Will we prosper here? Will our children be treated equally?
That is a very important point to make, and this documentary certainly raises all those issues. It's also a very political film, as you alluded to also. I just want to talk a little bit now about the politics of the film before we move on. So on the one hand, Mike, the official US narrative of the invasion of Grenada was that Grenada's government was working with so-called communist Cuba and wanted to make a base there. And Ronald Reagan, the president at the time, quote, said it was necessary to bring the spirit of freedom and to Grenada in the form of a military strike. But of course, this documentary goes against this narrative, doesn't it, and offers a different perspective.
It does. I think it what it succeeds in doing is presenting this counterperspective, because Damani Baker realizes that when the family moves away from Grenada, goes back to the USA, the image that he sees of Grenada in American media is very different from the image that he saw growing up. And, you know, you're getting the sense that American news media presented Ronald Reagan as this great liberator. You know, he went into Grenada and sorted the situation out, and all of a sudden it's much better for him doing that. And actually, Damani Baker, what he's done by making this film and piecing all these individual pieces of footage together that have been taken over the decades, what he's done is he's actually presented a very convincing counter-image to that claim, and the counter-image to what was the dominant image in American media at the time.
Mm. And I did a bit of more research, actually, on this topic, because I found it really interesting the way this documentary brought it up. And it was reported that a senior British officer who watched the Grenada invasion from Barbados, Major Mark Adkin, he wrote afterward, quote, that it was launched because of the intense desire of the president and his advisers to raise U.S. prestige, particularly at home and in the armed forces, where morale and self-respect had fallen substantially since the Vietnam War. Lee, do you think that this was the real reason then behind the invasion?
Well, yeah, there's nothing like crushing a little country to, reinforce one's flagging self-esteem. So that's a narrative we've seen in world politics. But I also think that you've got to remember that, you know, with Norman Manley in Jamaica at the time, that there was a very much sense that there might be a domino effect in relation to socialism, communism in the region.
The US perceived this as a threat?
The US perceived this as a very real threat that could see a swathe of Caribbean islands really moving to the left. Not far from their coast. And so a combination of hubris, arrogance, imperialism, and real genuine fear, I think, of the extent to which the Caribbean could be involved, fueled American ambition to try and stamp out any nascent light of an alternative socialist agenda in the region.
Very strongly put, and I'll just have to pause you there for now.
Hello, my name is Damani Baker. I am the director of The House on Cocoa Road, a documentary about my mother. My mom moved my sister and I from Oakland, California, where I was born and raised, to take part in the Grenada Revolution. So this film was about how we ended up in Grenada in the first place, how we ended up in a country that eventually would be invaded by the United States as my family hid under a bed when bombs dropped all around us. In order to understand that, I had to go back and retrace my mother's history, her story. Her story of having parents who were part of the Great Migration West, great-grandparents who were sharecroppers in the South, how she served children in the Black Panther Party's free breakfast program, and eventually became Angela Davis' teaching assistant at UCLA in the 60s. So this is a film about women leaders, it's about my mother, and it's about people who really imagined a better way to live.
So that was Damani Baker there himself speaking about the purpose of this film. And I think what's special about this documentary, and also quite unique, is that it offers, as well as being a political film, it offers an intimate look at Damani's personal life. What do we make of this sort of aspect of the film? Was it important?
Oh, very much so. I mean, it sort of falls into that kind of who do you think you are, that kind of the TV series where people look back into their roots. So it starts out as Damani Baker looking back and trying to figure out how on earth his family got here from there. So, you know, his great-grandmother was part of a sharecropping family in the American South, and there was the Great Migration, then civil rights, you know, the advances in civil rights. And he's trying to piece out where he falls in it. How come that he, as a young filmmaker, you know, has the time, and the leisure time, and the money to go around the world making movies, and you know,
even the title of the film, The House on Crooked Road, has a personal touch, doesn't it?
Yes, it's trying to sort of pin down places in the past and to sort of plot a, if you like, a sort of straight line. You know, how do we get here now in this moment, given everything that's gone before us, and given the indifference of white America to our family and our struggles? You know, how do we get through all that to get to where we are today? And you know, the archive footage is very important in sort of nailing down exactly where that family was at those particular times.
I suppose this is a very symbolic message then, Lee, that politics is kind of inseparable to Black African Americans and their life and their struggle to the present day.
Absolutely, deeply intertwined, and we very much live our lives vicariously through those politics. But I think it's also an interesting narrative on the phenomenon of migration in the modern world, and how those migratory tales can be best be told by the sort of intimate portrait of an individual or group of individuals who are seeking to make a better life for themselves and often escape, you know, horrendous and circumstances. So I think it speaks to that broader narrative. And within that, there's the African diaspora, which scattered across the four ends of the earth, is in a perpetual search for its own identity, its own place in the world, and very much the stepping stones from Africa to the West are seen as important steps along that story.
And that reminds me, actually, of what you were saying of the main protagonist in this documentary, Damani Baker's mother.
Yeah.
What did you make of her contribution, Mike?
It's very important that, actually, the bulk of the voices that you hear in this documentary are female. So it's Fanny, it's her friends and her neighbours in Grenada. It's about women trying to make a life for themselves and trying to raise a family. And it's also, the film itself is the work of a son trying to pay tribute to a mother who raised him right. And I think that's why it's so emotional and so affecting at the end of the day.
I'm here in Free Grenada for the very first time. The experiences that I've had here in Grenada have confirmed in a very powerful way where we are headed, what the future of the entire planet ought to look like. This beautiful, powerful militant revolution.
My sister Fania and I were so excited by what we saw. We were so struck by the enthusiasm of the, not only the leaders, but the everyday people. For us, Grenada, especially for Black people, really marked a new moment in history.
It just sort of captured the imagination of us. Here's a socialist government.
a revolutionary government right here in our own hemisphere.
There was legendary activist Angela Davis, world renowned scholar and activist and was a member of the Black Panther Party. Now, Lee, in the film, Granada was described by black people as being a sort of utopia for black people. And Maurice Bishop, the prime minister at the time, and he was tragically later shot dead, said, if we have 95% of predominantly African origin in our country, then we can have a dangerous appeal to 30 million black people in the United States. So why was there such a longing from African Americans for sort of this a strong black community and leadership?
I think very much African Americans had, coming out of the Vietnam War, were beginning to reassess their place in society. They'd taken part in the Olympics, they'd fought in world wars, and yet they were still facing the most horrendous police brutality and economic discrimination in the land of the home of the free and the land of the brave. And I think they began to fundamentally reassess, or at least some did, reassess the extent to which they could prosper in such societies. And as all African diasporas do, they looked to elsewhere in the world where their fortunes might be greater. And of course, there's a deep longing, a sort of Garveyan sense of the Jamaican leader Marcus Garvey, to build black nation, to build an example of how humanity can work together in a progressive way. And very much the ideals of Cuba and the Grenada revolutionary movement encapsulated for very many black diasporans, African diasporans, their desire to see black nationhood, to see progressive socialism encapsulated and led by, you know, not just Cuba, but joined in by other islands in and around the Caribbean. And as such, it elevated itself into a international country of appeal, where the revolutionary movement put out a worldwide appeal for Africans in the diaspora to come help rebuild Grenada and be part of that movement. And lots of people from the United Kingdom, from the United States, other parts of the world responded to that call.
That's very revealing indeed. I don't think many people know about this aspect of Granada from the black perspective.
Yeah.
And just speaking of that, Mike, I think also what's invaluable of Baker's documentaries, this archive material he has that juxtaposes sort of the propaganda and he touches on the role of the media. Mm-hmm. What is life like? How was life painted for black people in Granada, the reality of it?
Well, I mean, this is one of the important facets of this particular film. You get a sense of a place that is trying to, I think the phrase that Maurice Bishop uses, to throw off the Coca-Cola mentality and you know, go in a different direction. And so you do get the footage that we get here that was taken by Damani Baker's own family is very much from the ground up. You're seeing, you know, a kind of grassroots movement building. You know, you're seeing people, you know, taking control of their own destinies in a way that clearly threatened the Reagan administration. And you get this sort of strange sort of contrast between Angela Davis and that particular way of thinking and the Ronald Reagan way of thinking, which, you know, is a little, shall we say, slightly more fearful.
Yes. Resonates a lot with today, of course.
I think so. And, you know, those contrasts, yes, do have a resonance in what's going on in America today with the way certain white leaders are espousing their values.
We're not naming any names.
Not naming any names, no.
We'll have to move swiftly on just for now.
Ronald Reagan, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
All of a sudden, the drugs came in so heavy, it was scary, but it destroyed the entire city of Oakland. I mean, there's a discussion now where that came from. Entire black communities were destroyed. With all of my efforts to put you in a good school and try to balance it, there was still, we could sit on that hill in East Oakland and hear gunfire all down the hill all night.
It was very disappointing to see all the work that you've done being overrun by drugs. It was not a happy time in the black community anywhere in the States.
That was not an environment to raise children.
A little bit more of Angela Davis then. We talked a little bit about her, but I'd like to talk about her a little bit more just before we end the show. And Mike, what do you make of her contribution to this documentary?
It's very important. I mean, she turns up very early on in the film because Fanny Damani Baker's mother was a student of hers at the
UCLA.
And later became her assistant. So it's almost about the role of mentoring in American life, and how having a good mentor can, you know, change the way you think about the world, change the way you perceive the world. And I think Angela Davis becomes almost Fanny's mentor, you know, and takes her to protests and leads her into a more engaged way of thinking about the world.
And the documentary sheds light on her fair share of struggle, Angela Davis, in her life for racial equality. What does she mean for black activists everywhere?
Hugely symbolic figure for black activists worldwide. Continues to be an inspiration today for the millennials who you see in the Black Lives Matter movement and wider. African women on the continent still revere Angela Davis. She's held in extraordinarily high regard right across the world. And quite rightly so, when you think about the radical stance that she took, putting herself in danger, risking jail, risking a loss of her life, all for the principled struggle for justice and equality. Angela Davis, you know, remains a very sort of bright, burning firmament on the skyline. And she will be revered, I think, for a long time to come.
And what I found inspiring, actually, from this documentary was watching her leadership and how the black unions at the time in the 80s organized. Do you think movements today can learn a lot about that era?
Well, we look at the post-Weinstein movement and the Me Too movement, and we realize just how far we've got to come. People have to realize, when Angela Davis was doing what she was doing, we were talking about 1970s, late 60s America, where the kind of super black machismo was still very much of the sort of shaft. You know, militant young black man was still the focus of the struggle, and along comes Angela Davis, and in one stroke recenters that struggle, putting black women at the heart of that movement. It was revolutionary at the time, and when you look back on it, you have to appreciate just how significant it really was.
And Mike, we're running towards the end of the show now. I just wanted to get your final thoughts on this film, and would you recommend it?
Oh, very much so. I mean, I found it, you know, inspirational. I found it very engaging. I also found it very educational. I mean, I've not seen much treatment, cinematic treatment, of the events in Grenada. So to have a, you know, a first-hand perspective, to have people who are actually on the ground at the time telling the story in their own words, in this very laid-back, you know, very informal way, it was an education for me.
And Lee, if I could turn to you, your final thoughts, and would you recommend this film?
Definitely recommend the film. I think that anything that captures that sort of historical narrative from the victim perspective is going to offer really unique insights for people, and also for people to get a real appreciation of how important globally the Grenadian Revolution was to Africans right across the world.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I wish we could talk more, but we've run out of time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you again to both my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
Minutes. If you are in Yemen, you don't need to imagine yourself in all horrible situations. You're already part of this human tragedy. Among endless problems induced by the war, long hours of power outages have created an invisible pain that runs through the whole country. The power cuts reach 8 hours a day, sometimes reaching 24 hours. It's like hell. We cannot sleep because of the high heat. We are living and dying in the dark. These are common sentences that can be heard in Yemenis' everyday conversation.
When you see that they attack electricity stations, power lines, power stations as well, and also blockade the oil industry and the oil imports that is so necessary for the fuel, for the electricity production in Yemen. One of the major reasons behind this is that they want to break Yemen's spirit. These are attacks that no longer target military goods, military or equipment or soldiers of the Yemeni Republic.
Power outages have left almost all major cities in the dark since the onset of the war in 2015. The Saudi-led coalition has destroyed many transmission lines, power stations, and other electricity facilities, crippling the country's critical centers. Yemen's Ministry of Electricity says the coalition has targeted more than 5,000 power stations and other pieces of critical energy infrastructure, most of them away from any fighting or military site. According to the ministry, 90% of the total Yemeni population are living without electricity.
There have been several reports already that there are a lot of health centers. Reports speak about the majority of health centers and hospitals in Yemen having shut down due to a lack of power and due to a lack of fuel necessary to fuel their generators. And the same goes for institutions such as oxygen factories that produce necessary oxygen tanks and oxygen machinery and equipment in order to keep people alive during life-saving surgery.
In April 2016, Saudi warplanes destroyed the main power station in Taiz province. 4 months later, in August, they dropped bombs on two generating stations at Harath and Midi in Haja province. 8 bombs also targeted the main power station in Amran, destroying 2 transformers. The coalition had already bombed in July 2015 a compound housing employees of a power plant and their families, killing and injuring more than 300. Some families have reportedly pulled their children out of school to fetch water as electric pumps have become useless. And those students who still go to school cannot study without electricity when night comes. Needless to say, the surface water children and women fetch is often contaminated with cholera and other bacteria.
You have to bear in mind that take away a nation's electricity and you make them drop back decades, if not centuries, into the past. And whereas, of course, you can say, you know, in the past people survived as well, the sudden drawback, the sudden collapse that the sudden cutting of all power causes will immediately, and in the course of weeks and months even more, cause a mass amount of civilian deaths. This is basically unavoidable if you take such a drastic step as to cut off an entire nation's power for an extended period of time.
Meanwhile, a handful of factories that have survived the war are now closed down in the absence of electricity. Long-lasting power outages have been taking their toll on Yemeni patients whose lives are dependent on life-saving facilities.
when lengthy power outages occur and the emergency backup generators may not always cut the hits and may not always be enough to keep the power running for a long time in places such as hospitals, emergency centers, childcare services, factories that produce necessary medical and other equipment. So this has had a very intense direct result for thousands of people in Yemen who are suffering from medical conditions, people who have been wounded due to the bombings, for example, that Saudi Arabia has been carrying out in Yemen for years now.
Yemen's Public Electricity Corporation has estimated that the financial damage from these measured attacks on power infrastructure adds up to over $4 billion.
When they seek to destroy Yemen completely, this is their way of indeed reducing the country back to ashes, and then later on come back with some a few billions of petrodollars to build up the country back as a Saudi puppet state, and then portray the money that they gave as an act of charity. This is a very typical Saudi strategy that we have seen in this region in particular.
Yemeni citizens now have to pay a monthly subscription fee of up to 350 to 400 Yemeni riyals to private sector producers. Many Yemeni families cannot afford it. Before the war, it was just 7 Yemeni riyals per kilowatt. Years of indiscriminate airstrikes and bombardments have destroyed the national grid and contaminated large areas across Yemen, including areas through which power lines pass, turning them into fields full of mines and unexploded bombs. In the words of Abdul Qadir Motahar, Director General of Transportation at the Electricity Corporation, "We have 490 electric towers in the Sana'a Marib line that passes through now, most of which are now destroyed or affected by the raids, shelling, and unexploded ordnance."
The blame for Western countries goes much further than merely selling weapons. Of course, when you sell weapons, I mean, my native country of Belgium has recently ceased selling weapons directly to much of the Saudi military, but not all, I believe. But before that, the Belgian government always said, like, we sell these weapons to the Saudis. What they do with it afterwards is not exactly our fault. You know, that is, they try to kind of turn around a little bit and shift the blame away that way. But the blame goes much further than that, especially in countries like the United Kingdom and the United States. They don't just sell weapons to Saudi Arabia, but they are directly involved in intelligence services. There are American and British forces and Israeli forces and experts directly present in the war rooms of the Saudi-led coalition.
The Yemeni Executive Mine Action Center says the dense amount of mines and unexploded ordnance that are now spread near electric transmission lines is huge. It'll take a long time before teams are able to reach them to start the rebuilding process. It is clear that a poor country like Yemen, which cannot secure even the basic staples of life, cannot get rid of these huge amounts of unexploded remnants and landmines in the near future. With the help of Ansarullah, Yemeni citizens have just started using solar energy. But the question is, will the Saudi-led coalition allow them to use it for a long time? And will light overcome darkness in the end?
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.